Sounds True presents Your Buddha Nature, Part 5, The Perfection of Prajna, Wisdom, with Jack Kornfield.
I'd like to speak about the quality of wisdom, prajna. When we've told the story earlier on this fall of the perfection of these qualities in the development of the Buddha, the story of the Buddha, that these were perfected over 100,000 mahakalpas of lifetimes, eons of compassion, or generosity, or patience, or integrity, which in a sense means that it's outside of time, that it's timeless. It's kind of dangerous to use the word perfection when speaking in spiritual circumstances, because it's easy to confuse it. And what does it mean, the quality of perfection? That we're supposed to perfect our body with enough tofu and proper vegetables and vitamins and, you know, jogging and body work, or that we're supposed to perfect our personality with the proper kinds of therapy and, you know, personality work. What you get then often is what Marion Woodman described in her book, Addiction to Perfection. That quality that comes in us that feels like the way we are is not right. And if only I could be thinner or, you know, different in some way, then I would be fine. If only I could make myself more perfect. But the wisdom that we speak of isn't to make ourselves different, but rather the discovery of the great perfection that exists already within us and in the universe itself, in the truth of the universe, that perfection that is here and that is eternal. So prajna, the word for wisdom, there's this great text, the Sutra of Complete and Perfect Wisdom in 80,000 verses. It's then summed up in 8,000 verses and 800 verses, and fortunately, as most of you know, it's summarized in one syllable, ah. And the reason that ah is the sound of wisdom, the first sound, the last sound, it's called, the seed syllable ah, is because it's the sound of opening or letting go, of the wisdom of being present with things as they are. It's important that wisdom not be confused with knowledge. There's knowledge of science, and there's knowledge of art, and there's knowledge of medicine, and there's knowledge in different spiritual ways, past lives and psychology and all these things. That's the things that we learn and learn about. But that's not wisdom. Nor is wisdom power. There are some very powerful people. Even in the spiritual circles, you can meet people who have certain kinds of spiritual powers, just as you can have knowledge of the world, scientific, technological power. And sometimes the power is associated with wisdom, and sometimes it's not at all. You know, and you can meet people who have the powers, even as it's said, I don't know, I haven't seen it, to walk on water. Okay, I mean, you could also take a boat. But what is its real value? But what is it that we look for most authentically in a spiritual practice? So is it power? Is it knowledge? Well, I know about this and that. What is it? This is from Corinthians. If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am become as sounding brass or clanging gong. And if I have the gift of prophecy and know all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to move mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. What is it that is really essential to awakening to our hearts? It's said that there are three stages in the opening or the depth of wisdom: Sutamaya Panya, Jintamaya Panya, and Bhavanamaya Panya. Panya and Prajna are the same word in Pali or Sanskrit. The discovery of wisdom. The first is that discovery or remembrance of wisdom that comes reflected in what we hear or see outside of ourselves. Oh, yes, now I remember that truth, that wisdom. Somehow it comes from outside. The second comes from our own reflection and consideration and thought and observation, already a bit deeper. But the third, and the most authentic wisdom, comes from that knowing in our heart of what is wise and what is true. I've written before a story of, true story, of a woman who came to see me in Western Massachusetts, in the Amherst area. She'd been married to a doctor who had been quite beloved in the community around and then suddenly died. And many people grieved his loss. And they had friends, they'd been involved in a broad spiritual circle, as one might be in Marin, and Tibetan practice and Vipassana and other kinds of practice. So when the memorial service and the ways of helping her came, people from the whole spiritual community. And after some weeks of her own grieving and dealing with his loss, she met a good friend involved in Tibetan practice who said, you know, it's fine, it's okay, don't worry about him, because I've been doing the 49-day recitation from the Tibetan Book of the Dead and these deep meditations that my Lama taught me, and I've seen him. And he is in the bardo of the blue light of this particular bodhisattva, and he's fine, he'll be okay. Kind of reassuring. She felt somewhat reassured by hearing that. But a couple of days later, she met a dear friend in the Christian contemplative community there, a Christian mystic, who came up to her very excited and said, you know, it's so important. I've been waiting to tell you. I was doing my prayer and my meditation, and I saw him, you know, and he is with the ascended masters, and I saw him in this light, and it's really, he's just fine, and I hope you can feel it, and this is what he said, and so forth. She got a little confused. So she went to call a man, a teacher that she'd admired much, who was a Sufi teacher in the community and one of the wise people. She called him to kind of work this out with him and so forth. She got him on the phone, and before she could ask her question, he said, I have something I have to tell you. He is already in the womb. He's just been conceived, and he's in the womb of a woman in Washington, D.C., and I know just where he is. She didn't know whether to hang the phone up or cry or whatever. So she came to talk to me, which, as you can hear, was a kind of a mistake, but taking it for what it was, sat down with her. She told me this story and she said, I don't know what to believe anymore. You know, where is he? What happens when you die? Does anybody know what happens when you die? So we sat for a bit and I said, you know, I'm not going to give you another answer. You've got more answers, you know, than I could possibly make up. I said, but suppose that you don't look for an answer, since all these people who you've even trusted and valued have said different kind of competing things. Suppose instead you were just to sit with me and close your eyes for a minute. We did a kind of meditation. and reflect on all the things that you've heard and read and been told spiritually. This is what happens when you die, or that's what happens, and this is what's important, or that. You reflect on all those things, and you let them go for a moment, and you rest in yourself, in your own knowing, in what my teacher Ajahn Chah called the one who knows deep within you. And ask yourself simply, is there anything that you know so certainly that it doesn't matter what anybody else has to say about it? Even if Buddha came in the room and said it's not so, you'd look him in the eye and say, yes, it is. And she sat there and she said, I don't know very much, but I know that everything changes. That I know. And I looked at her and I said, perhaps that's enough. If you could really live from that knowledge, what Zen Master Suzuki Roshi summed up all of Buddhism as, three words, not always so. If you could live from that knowing that everything changes, maybe that would be wisdom enough. Because then you take nothing for granted. It's so here for such a short time. And you also realize that you can't grasp anything. Your children, your lovers, your husband, your own body, your whoever it is, they're there for a time and then gone. What is it that you really know? I've asked this question in groups at other times. What is it that we really know to be true, independent of what anyone has said? Someone raised their hand and said, whatever point of view I have, I know that there's another point of view on it. That I know. Isn't that interesting? You know, or someone else raised their hand. There is light and dark, and birth and death, and joy and sorrow. And they seem to be connected, that one follows after another. This is the beginning of the true sense of wisdom. It's not your knowledge. It's not something you accumulate. It's not something, a matter of the past or the future. It's a seeing what is so just now. That simple. This is from the Tao. It says, when people see some things as beautiful, other things become ugly. When people see some things as good, other things become bad. Being and non-being create each other. Difficult and easy support each other. Long and short define one another. High and low depend on one another. Therefore, the wise person, the master, acts without fighting anything and teaches without saying anything. Whoops. Things arise and she lets them come. And when things disappear, she lets them go. She has but doesn't possess, acts without expecting. So when everything is done, she remains at peace. Wisdom is simple, and it is always here in this moment. It's not of the past or the future. It is always now. Someone went to see the great Indian sage Ramana Maharshi and said, oh Master Ramana, can you speak to us about future lives, what happens when we die, and past lives, and can you tell about that? You're such a wise man. And he looked back at them with the greatest compassion, and then he laughed a little bit, the laughter of the wise. That's a very sweet quality. He said, already your life has many troubles. Why should you wish to know of future lives? Do you want more trouble? Why don't you know the present first? Discover the eternal truth that is here and now, and all of your questions will be answered from that. I was sitting in the forest monastery of my teacher, Ajahn Chah, many years ago. Late 1960s. One night, after we had finished our meditations and chanting, and it was dark in the forest, sitting around a clearing with a few monks, just kind of hanging out after we'd done our monkly duties of chanting and meditation, talking a little bit. The stars were very bright because it was the place where there were no electric lights. You could really see the sky. And in the middle of all these stars went this very bright star slowly and steadily right across the sky. And one of the old monks looked at me and he said, "What's that?" And he said, "Nan ben arai." I said, "Nan riakwa satellite." "Satellite, what is a satellite?" he asked. So I thought, all right, how do I explain this to this guy? So he was born in probably the 1890s. You know, I had maybe a second or third grade education. And I said, "Well, where do I start?" I said, "Well, first of all, the earth is round." I said, "Oh, really? You know, I'm serious. This is where you start." And I got a rock and I did the elementary school thing. Here's the globe and here's the sun and the earth turns and it makes it seem like the sun is going from one place to another. But really it's the earth that's turning, going around in its orbit. Took my little flashlight and showed how that worked, right? And then I talked about rockets, you know, how you blow up a balloon and then when you let the air out, it goes one way, and that's how rockets work, and that the satellite was going around the earth. This rocket had put it up there. He kind of listened. I'm not sure he believed me. And then he said, "If it's round, how come you don't fall off the bottom?" Stuff, you know, those basic, well, why does it look flat? Which it does. And what was amazing is, even though he didn't know that the earth was round, he was considered by many a really wise man. And he had a gracious heart and kind of wisdom that people would seek him out and say, "These are my problems, and you know, what should I do? I'm in this struggle, I have this conflict." And there's something at peace in him, at rest in his heart, and he'd say yes and give some simple answer. Can you hear the difference between wisdom and knowledge? He didn't even know the world was round. What is wisdom? It is likened to a lamp that has been relit, that has gone out or overturned and set back up and lit, like a light in the darkness, like the sun arising in the heart, like an awakening that sees clearly on a clear morning. Thich Nhat Hanh is always speaking about seeing deeply. Not just seeing what's here with this beginning mindfulness we practice, but taking it, that quality of mindfulness, and allowing us to see what is so. Now, we're not so much trained to see in that way. We're trained to be busy and accomplish rather than to listen and see deeply. I read in the paper that in Michigan State, the Psychological Service of the State Department of Education developed a program to be implemented statewide for reducing the stress levels that were measured in the school-age children. You know how it is these days, even the kids' homework, and then you have to go to, you know, soccer practice and get up early and go back to school and then go to this and that. And even our kids are running around, don't have so much time to play. And the program centered around the introduction of deep and relaxing breathing. But after 2 months, the Michigan program was canceled due to a rash of parent complaints that the effect of breathing was producing mystical experiences and other non-Christian states in their children. This is true. So watch out with this breathing stuff. So what is wisdom? To be present with wisdom. Wisdom has a spacious-like quality and a mirror-like quality of action. Let's take the spacious quality first. That quality of wisdom that is open, at peace, not in conflict with the world, born out of awareness and wholeness of heart. That we're here with a kind of clarity, simply at peace to see the way things are. And in that wisdom, we begin to discover the nature of life, the laws of things. We see the seasons of life, like my friend Rodney Smith, who's a Dharma teacher and hospice director, who said he had this 96-year-old woman come into his hospice, you know, who was getting closer to death, and she was complaining, "Why me?" He said he couldn't believe it, but it was true. You know, why me? Wisdom that sees things as they are without adding to them how it's supposed to be. Again, from the Tao. Fill your bowl to the brim and it will spill. Keep sharpening your knife and it will blunt. Chase after money and security and your heart will never unclench. Care about people's approval and you will be their prisoner. Do your work, then step back. Find the path to serenity. When you are content to be simply yourself and let all things be, without comparing or competing, everything will rest in the Tao. From the Buddha, the wind cannot shake a mountain, and neither praise nor blame can touch the wise, the place of wisdom in us. So this is the spaciousness or clarity where the heart is big enough to contain all things and rests as if in the center of this great dance that is our life. The change of seasons, the coming and going of people that we love and don't like and hate and want more of and want less of. Resting in a place of knowing and really a place of eternity. Every particle of everything, rock, water, flower, human being, has been in the same place, flaming in the heart of an ancient sun before the earth came flying out of it. All of us. The irises of your eyes, the tissues of roses, the slow giant rocks in the hearts of mountains were all born together, flaming, locked in the sun as it drifted as a light on the dark waters of space. It's where we come from, all of us. It's amazing, isn't it? It seems so separate, but just for a time. So the wisdom of the heart knows this, sees the preciousness of us all together, and also sees the eternal laws that govern this opening or unfolding, the laws of karma. What is in our heart creates how things will be. Hatred never ceases by hatred, but by love alone is healed. This is the ancient and eternal law. What we practice and create becomes the new forms that arise in this space of heart and mind. The thought manifests as the word. The word manifests as deed. The deed develops into habit. The habit hardens into character. So watch the thought and its ways with care, and let it spring from love, born out of concern for all beings. From the place of wisdom, one sees the creation in each moment of the next moment and the next. To rest in this knowing, in this one who knows, in the present, the here and now, wisdom also sees the law of joy, that when the heart is open, it is possible to bring blessings even in the greatest difficulty. Even in the greatest difficulty, we can offer our blessings. And in all the worlds, wherever one finds oneself, it sees the truth of sorrow, the Buddha's first noble truth. There's birth and death and pain and sorrow. Yes, as you say, yes, there is. Anybody not seen that? And then there is the suffering that comes when we contract and fight and struggle. From the body of fear there arises greed and hatred and ignorance and delusion, conflict, warfare, grasping. There's the cause of sorrow that I speak of, and there's the end of sorrow. Wisdom knows the possibility of freedom in any moment, no matter what situation in our life, the possibility of freedom. I remember being with my good friend and colleague Sharon Salzberg some years ago when Ajahn Chah visited our meditation center in Massachusetts in Barrie. And he was there. We were leading a retreat, and he was giving teachings and talking to people. And we were out on the lawn. I think it was a beautiful spring day. Ajahn Chah and myself and Sharon taking a walk. And he looked at her. Sharon was, it was probably 1979, so Sharon was, been teaching for 5 years, and she was 26 years old. She started to teach at age 21 as a Dharma teacher. She went to India at 17. And he looked at her and he said, "You're kind of young to be teaching, aren't you?" Something like that. And then he said, "You know, let me ask you about your teaching." He was always testing people and teasing them. He liked to do that. He said, "Now the Buddha teaches suffering and the end of suffering." He said, "Are you finished with your suffering? Have you finished?" And she looked back at him and she said, "No." And he said, he wasn't surprised. He said, "Then how can you teach other people if you haven't finished with your own suffering?" She reflected for a minute. She looked back. She said, "I can teach because I know the cause of suffering. And I do know its end. Even if I haven't finished, I know what its cause is, and I know that it has an end." This is space like wisdom. It's the wisdom that is present with things, not by knowing, but an openness of heart or being. It's more an unknowing. The Christian mystical text is called the cloud of unknowing. About this, or Zen Master Sansanin, the Korean teacher, talks about cultivating don't know mind. In his teachings, he'll look at people and he'll say, "Who are you? Who are you really? Where did you come from? Don't know. What is love? You all looking for love. What is that love? Don't know. Well, what is consciousness? Who is hearing me? What is this thing that animates us all? Don't know. Well, where did this earth come from? Don't know." He says, "Ah, good. You keep don't know mind. Only don't know." All day somebody says something, "Don't know. Just look. Don't know." It's not about knowing, but a presence in this mystery. From the beloved Zen poet, Zen Master Ryokan. "Day after day I go to town. Today's begging is finished. At the crossroads I wander by the side of the Buddhist shrine, talking with some children. Last year, a foolish monk. This year, no change." So one quality then of wisdom is this spaciousness of heart. Yes. And yes, and yes. And that presence has mystery and wonder and appreciation. And a kind of joy for life itself. Spaciousness of wisdom, and then mirror-like wisdom. Mirror-like wisdom comes as we sit. We find this quality of wisdom that comes of spaciousness. When we are called to action, when we get up from our sitting, finding this place of rest, knowing, or joy, look around really. Who are we? Are we separate from one another, from the trees that breathe together with us, from the water that makes up our body, from the thoughts that television has placed into your mind, you know, being beamed out to everyone from transmitters all around? You live in illusion and the appearance of things, says Kala Rinpoche. There is a reality, but you do not know this. And when you understand it, you will see that you are nothing. And being nothing, you are everything. That is all. We are in some ways nothing, nothing separate. And being nothing, we are everything. It's not just a philosophy, but more and more a direct experience of life. So wisdom sees this, the seeing, the knowing, and then responds. The mirror-like wisdom is the wisdom of action, or you could call it the wisdom of compassion. Seeing the divine play, the heart responds particularly to the entanglement of ourselves and other beings. So one Buddhist text ends, "Now in the final insight, you know how to leave everything alone without cutting it off, yet not falling under its spell." So that's sort of the culmination of this practice of sitting, allowing things to be received with compassion and openness. To leave everything alone, not cutting it off at all, yet not falling under its spell. And from this place of openness, there is now born in you exceeding compassion for all those living creatures who do not realize the emptiness and are of all things and are entangled by their minds. And thus you will spend your life working for the sake of these others, yet all your meditations have cleansed away any idea that these others actually exist separate from yourself. You have realized that every event is innate and spontaneous and is the body of reality itself, that you and the world are one. So the mirror-like wisdom sees sorrow, and as soon as it appears, there comes, as naturally as our own breath, the response of compassion. You see someone who's sick, and you bring the medicine. You see the hungry, and you feed them. You see injustice, and to the extent you can, you respond to that injustice. You see the poor in spirit, and you offer them the medicine of awakening, the medicine of the Dharma. You see happiness, and you respond with joy. It's not far away. You know this in yourself. You know if you see a child who falls down and is crying or something's happened, what happens in you? Like a mirror, immediately there is that response. It is there in each of us. It is not far away when we are present. When we step out of the small sense of self, this quality of wisdom arises in a moment and responds. You see confusion, and there arises clarity, discriminating wisdom, the sword of King Solomon to cut through the illusion. The quality of wisdom is fearless. It sees what is true and can speak of peace in wartime and truth in the face of injustice, yet it does so with compassion. And there's so many skillful means, as many beings as there are in this room. There are that many skillful ways that wisdom will manifest. Often very practically. This wonderful old yogi and saint teacher in India, Deepama, who we practiced with. One of the young men who went over to India to practice in the times when I was in Asia and Joseph and Sharon were there, sitting retreats, but his parents were very upset that he wasn't going to graduate school or getting a job, and he was kind of bumming around India and studying this meditation stuff, particularly his mother, really upset, would write angry letters and so forth. And every time he went to see Deepa Ma, this teacher I spoke of, she would say, "Have you heard from your mother? And are you writing her back? And how is your mother?" She didn't ask, "How's your meditation?" She asked, "How's your mother?" Right? And he'd say, "Oh, she's having a hard time, or she's angry, I'm here." And after a couple of times of that, Deepa Ma went into her bedroom and kind of reached underneath her mattress and pulled out a couple of, you know, 100-rupee notes, which were a lot of money for her. She didn't put money in the bank. You didn't do that in India in those days, just tuck it under the mattress. And she said, "Here, go buy a present for your mother and mail it to her." Just that simple. "How's your mother? She's angry. Here, go buy a present. Buy her a gift and mail something to her." I had a friend who came to me back from practicing in Asia. She'd been a nun in Burma for a while. She said every time she went to see her parents, it was difficult. Her parents lived in Baltimore, and they were kind of working class, and she'd go as this, you know, Burmese nun, and it just didn't fit very well, and they'd be watching TV, watching the game, and drinking beer and stuff like that, and she was only eating in the morning and trying not to eat meat and stuff like that, and she was trying to go back, and she just, I can't say she was tearing her hair out because she had her head shaved, but it was like that. So we sat down and I reminded her, I said, "You know, even the Buddha had trouble with his parents when he went back. It's true. They didn't believe. They said, you know, 'What are you doing wearing that rag robe and begging out in the streets? Come back in the palace and dress properly.'" And he had to do a couple of miracles before they even believed that he, you know, anything had happened. "Oh, son, I see something is different after all, you know." And if you read about Jesus, it's the same. He went back to his hometown and he was not very well received. So I said, "So it's not, an unusual problem." She said, "Well, what am I supposed to do? You know, they really hate me and they're angry, and I go back and I try and tell them what I'm doing. They won't listen, and, you know, they're doing all these awful things." And I said, "Listen, take off your robes. Just go back, you know. Don't try and be a nun or something special. Go back. Have a beer. Just one beer won't kill you. Sit down and watch the game with them. And just love them how they are. And one more thing. Don't stay too long." And she tried it. You know, 2 days. Had a beer. Ate dinner with them. Watched the game. Had a fine time. Loved them as they were, and they loved her. Wisdom is not very far away, and it's not complicated. I was called not so long ago by a friend in this community who was dying of cancer. And this particular woman, very beautiful being, she was a caregiver and a person who had served in her life and helped people in all kinds of ways. And so she had this big circle of friends, and they were all coming and wanting to take care of her and give her massages and give her things to eat and things like that. And she was turning them away, and they were all angry about it. You know, "This is our dear friend who's done so much for us." And I went and I spent some time sitting with her and breathing, meditating, just talking, listening. And it turned out, as we talked, that she'd spent her whole life caring for everybody else, and she'd hardly ever had a moment of solitude. And then she realized somehow that she didn't know about stillness, but that she needed to learn it. That it was coming to be a time where she actually had to do something all by herself, that nobody could go with her. You know what I mean? And she said, "I really have to do this. And I can't have all these people who I've done these things for coming and wanting to, you know, do things for me. It actually doesn't work." And we had a meeting with the circle of her friends and said, "You know, she's given all these things and you love her. And guess what? She has to die a different way than you want her to. She has to die her own way. And that's what she needs to do." And out of it, everyone could bow to one another and say, oh, this is the way that it is. Wisdom. The wisdom to be present, not to ignore this body, our families, the community, the environment. The mirror-like wisdom sees the circumstances of our life and responds to it in a natural way. It doesn't get excessive. Paul Reps, the Brooklyn Zen master, put it this way. He said, everything in moderation, including moderation. All right? So it's not like it always has to be this way, or that's always supposed to be quiet, or it's not supposed to be quiet. It responds with the heart, knows what is right in this moment, from that place of peace, from a place, my teacher used to laugh a lot. People would come with all these problems, and he would laugh. You know, that's an interesting one. Wonder what we're going to do about that one. You know? Do you understand that? Mirror-like wisdom teaches us the greatness of heart, or the capacity that we have as human beings to stay present and bear witness to the injustice and the sorrow of the world and the beauty of the world as well, to take the world as our own and give ourselves to it, to hold, to respond, to stay present in this wise and fearless way is to find a place of rest in all the changing circumstances of the world, to live fully and compassionately, and to die at peace. And I end with a Hasidic story that tells of seeing with the eyes of wisdom. An old rabbi once asked his pupils how they could tell when night had ended and the day had begun, because many sacred ceremonies can only begin when the night is finished and the day has begun, the end of the Sabbath, for example. How can you tell, Rabbi? Could it be, said one of the students, when you can see an animal in the distance and tell whether it's a sheep or a dog? No, answered the rabbi. Then another asked, is it when you can look at a tree in the distance and there's enough light to tell whether it's a fig tree or a peach tree? No, answered the rabbi. Then when is it? The pupils demanded. It is when you can look on the face of any man or woman and see that that is your sister or brother, because if you cannot see this, it is still night. Let's sit. And as we sit together, allow yourself to sense this inherent wisdom, your own knowing, your own Buddha nature, in which the heart is like great space that sees and knows all things that arise and rests in peace. Let me ask you in this stillness, with your heart as a mirror, when sorrow arises, How does your heart respond? When joy arises, how does your heart respond? When conflict arises, how does your heart respond? When beauty arises, how does the heart respond? When injustice arises, how does the heart respond? As you notice the feelings and responses that come, let yourself sense as well the space within which these feelings and words and thoughts arise and pass away, that great spacious knowing. Feelings come and go. Words arise and pass. The breath moves like a breeze. The heart of wisdom is always now, here. Finally, imagine one of the difficulties of your life. And let yourself picture, remember it, and see it with the eyes of wisdom, with the heart of compassion, that difficulty. And then let it go, that place of wisdom with the difficulty, and just be at peace, because it's not here now.
This concludes part 5 of Your Buddha Nature with Jack Kornfield. Please turn the tape over for part 6.